Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, this is June 2009's edition of the Chemistry World Podcast with James Mitchell-Crowe, Matt Wilkinson and Nina Notman. In this month's show, solar cells, but with a difference. Scientists have discovered what GFP, green fluorescent protein, really does.
Teams before had just assumed that protein was involved in bioluminescence, perhaps jellyfish just signalling to each other. But it turns out, potentially, this is the first example ever known of animal photosynthesis.
James Mitchell-Crowe, who will be here with more on that story very shortly. And also on the way, how scientists have found an unusual chemical in frog spawn.
On a much larger scale, on a sort of industrial or chemical scale, we had imagined that these surfactant proteins, which are biodegradable, might be useful in dispersing things like oil spillages.
And how nanotechnology can lend a helping hand to the treatment of diabetes.
What these researchers have done is developed a nanoparticle that actually responds to high levels of glucose and can release insulin to help break up the glucose and mitigate any effects that diabetes might have.
Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and this is Chemistry World.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
65 million years ago, the rule of the dinosaurs came to an end, and all we had left of them were the rocky replicas of their bones, which are otherwise known as fossils. Or so we thought, because in recent years, scientists have rocked the geological world by saying that they found genuine dinosaur tissue trapped inside multi-million-year-old fossils. And now they've got even more evidence to back up that claim, Nina.
Well, the group who are publishing in Science from North Carolina State University certainly believe so. So they've been looking at an 80-million-year-old skeleton of a duck-billed dinosaur, which is also called a hadrosaur, and they found fragments of protein collagen, which is the principal protein in connective tissue, buried within the skeleton.
How are they getting what they think is this tissue out of 80-million-year-old rock?
They demineralise the bone, and then they take what they've got left and they put it through a mass spec machine, and from that they can identify the sequence of amino acids within the fragments and tell that it is collagen.
This is Mary Schweitzer, isn't it, who's done this work, because she caused a bit of controversy a few years ago, saying that she was seeing tissue from Tyrannosaurus rex. And that didn't go down too well with the dinosaur community.
No, so this was, 2 years ago, and they were looking at this time a 68-million-year-old T-Rex, and she found the same results as she found this time, that she found collagen fragments within the skeleton. But, yeah, the community found this work quite controversial, and they were suggesting that there were contamination from more modern proteins in there. So this time a lot more care was taken to prove that there wasn't any contamination. And as well as her doing the mass spec, she also asked a number of other groups to repeat the experiment to see if they found the same results, and they did.
And how does the mass spec signature from that collagen compare with what's around today? Presumably that's how they're drawing their conclusions about the fact this is real.
So the T-Rex and the Hadrosaurus had quite similar profiles, and they have quite similar profiles to some modern bird today, so to the ostrich and to chickens. And surprisingly, it's much more similar to ostrich and chickens than it is to lizards.
And that fits because, of course, birds are the closest surviving relatives of dinosaurs.
That's what the fossil theory says, yes. So this work is supporting the previous theory.
Well, good on her. Let's hope it does turn out to be slightly better received this time. Thanks, Nina. And James, from land and big animals on land to the sea, and something that won a Nobel Prize, in fact, last year, for the people who discovered it, but we still didn't until now know what green fluorescent protein was all about.
That's right, Chris. Teams before had just assumed that this protein was involved in bioluminescence, perhaps jellyfish just signalling to each other. But it turns out that this protein might actually have originally had quite a different role within the animal, and potentially this is the first example ever known of animal photosynthesis. So this is not just a molecule that passively absorbs and emits light, but is actually an active light capturer, if you like.
And how does it feed the energy from the light into the animal? Because obviously in a plant you have chlorophyll, this captures the light and then feeds energy into various other chemical pathways. How does the jellyfish do it with GFP then?
Well, what the jellyfish is doing, this team think at the Shymaikin-Odchakhinov Institute in Moscow, is that what it does is feeds electrons. So it interacts with electron-accepting molecules within the cells of the animal. How they've actually proved this is it was previously known that when this protein is short of electrons, it doesn't fluoresce green, it fluoresces red. So what they did was they put the protein in a test tube with a variety of electron acceptors and shone blue light on it. The protein initially fluoresced green and then slowly turned to fluoresce red, showing that it's giving out these electrons. So it's acting like a light-activated electron donor, which is exactly what chlorophyll does in plant photosynthesis.
But is there anything in the cells for it to give that energy to?
Yes, there's cells naturally have all sorts of electron acceptors. The team haven't identified exactly if animal photosynthesis was taking place, what the receptor might be. But what they did was took live cells, added the fluorescent protein and shone the light on it. And exactly the same thing happened. Initially, it fluoresced green and then the fluorescence soon turned to red, showing that this electron donating process was taking place inside the live cells.
And so the next step will now be to firm that up and to show that these jellyfish are deriving sufficient or significant amounts of energy from sunlight.
Well, that will definitely be one of the things that they investigate. The speculation is that the primary function of this protein was some sort of light harvesting, and that the secondary function that it evolved was the sort of the more bioluminescence properties. So perhaps these jellyfish are not harvesting the light now, and the protein has evolved further since then. But what they do suggest is green fluorescent protein has been well used as a gene marker, which is what won these teams the Nobel Prize last year. And they suggest that because of this sort of colour-changing effect, what they could use this protein for in experiments is to sort of monitor redox reactions going on in proteins, for example, or even to manipulate redox reactions by shining in the light and getting the electron donating to take place.
Thanks, James. And on the subject of things aquatic, Alan Cooper's been studying a breed of frogs that have spawned a new way to treat burns and even to clean up oil slicks.
Well, we discovered a curious observation that many frogs, especially frogs in tropical areas, build foam nests to act as incubators for their developing eggs and tadpoles. And these turned out to be the nests of this particular frog in Trinidad called the tungara, or the mud puddle frog. Now, they actually look like egg white, which has been whipped up to form a rather sticky but glutinous foam. And this foam is produced by a combined activity of the male and the female. During mating, the male gives the female a little squeeze, and she produces some eggs and a mixture of materials, which the male frog then gathers up with his hind legs, fertilizes the eggs, and also whips up this mixture in using an action very much like an egg beater to produce this foamy mass.
And how big is each of the nests?
It's about the size of a grapefruit.
So they're quite large?
They are quite large, yes. And quite often the frogs do this communally. So you end up with groups of two, three, half a dozen of these foams, and it can make quite a big mass of foam at the edge of a pond or a puddle.
And the eggs are embedded within the foamy material?
That's right. They are mostly clustered around the centre. There seems to be some way in which the male contrives to bury the eggs so they're not too close to the surface, where they might get slightly damaged by dehydration.
And what's the purpose of doing this?
The purpose for the frogs is it's a way of incubating their eggs under conditions where there isn't very much standing water, because these are tropical regions. The next day the sun comes out and the pond or the puddle will dry out. But these nests will remain hydrated, they'll remain moist, and the tadpoles can develop quite happily inside.
What about predators? By predators, I mean other animals coming along and eating them, and also microbial predators, funguses, bacteria, that kind of thing.
There's little or no predation that we've observed. Microbial infestation is potentially a problem, and that is another interest, because of the water that these nests are made in or from is very heavily contaminated. We've done bacterial analysis, and the foams are absolutely chock-a-block with microbial organisms of all sorts of nasty descriptions. In many cases, the ponds or the puddles that these nests are made in are cesspits or other undesirable areas. But what we've observed is, although there is a lot of microbial infestation, the bacteria and the fungi do not seem to proliferate, and they certainly don't decompose the nest during the 3 or 4 days that the tadpoles need to reach maturity and then escape.
Very interesting biologically, but now chemically, how does it work? How are they doing this? And what's in that foam?
There are two problems, really. First of all, the frog has to make the foam, and we know as chemists that in order to make foam or a froth, the sort of thing we do in washing up liquids and in normal detergents, is you have to reduce the surface tension of the water, first of all, to produce a foam. Now, conventional small molecule detergents, the sorts of things we do use in the kitchen or the bathroom, would be bad news for the sensitive biological membranes of the cells and of the eggs and the sperm. So one of the proteins that we discovered turns out to be a naturally surfactant protein, a much larger molecule than we're used to as chemists, with, we believe, an unusual mechanism for its surfactant activity, which allows it to reduce the surface tension of the water and therefore initially allow formation of the froth or the foam, but without disrupting sensitive biological membranes. Then, having made the foam, it has to remain physically stable and biologically stable for a period of days. In fact, we know that if we take the eggs away from the nest, the foam material itself will survive up to 10 days under hot, steamy, tropical conditions without decomposing. Now, that's unusual because foams are unstable structures and will normally collapse. And we know that the head on a glass of beer or soap suds in the shower will collapse after just a few minutes or a few hours at most. That doesn't happen in the case of our frog foams. And the reason for that is, we believe, down to another set of proteins that we've discovered in this mixture, which have the capacity to cross-link some of the carbohydrate components in the frog mixture as well. I should have mentioned that we've identified six unusual proteins in this mixture, but there's also an equal abundance of long-chain, heavily branched carbohydrate, which we've really not characterized at all. But some of the proteins that we've identified can actually bind to carbohydrate. These lectins, these carbohydrate-binding proteins in the mixture, will cross-link and stabilize the foam once it's been formed, and that will perform a dual function of giving it physical stability for a long period of time and also retaining moisture, because the carbohydrates are very good at soaking up water as well, so that when the sun comes out, the foam doesn't dry out and leave the poor tadpoles dehydrated.
What sorts of things could you do with this?
So the very first thing that occurred to us is, if you have a biocompatible foam material, has a long lifetime, has antimicrobial properties, then you might think of using it as a treatment for wounds or burns in accident situations. You might also imagine squirting this foam into surgical cavities, either to act as a scaffold for tissue regeneration or even, perhaps for cosmetic surgery. These surfactant proteins also have a potential for coating surfaces which would not normally be wettable. On a much larger scale, on a sort of industrial or chemical scale, we had imagined that these surfactant proteins, which are biodegradable, might be useful in dispersing things like oil spillages, which otherwise are difficult to disperse and also harmful to the environment. And given that we can now produce these proteins by recombinant techniques, we don't have to decimate the frog population. We can actually produce these proteins and even engineer them in different ways in-house and then produce them at will.
Glasgow University chemist Alan Cooper. And now to the question of solar power and how we can make more efficient solar cells. Scientists at Sweden's Royal Institute of Technology have made a breakthrough, Matt.
Yes, indeed, Chris. But first, let me wind back a little bit. In 1991, a group in Switzerland invented a new way of making dye-sensitised solar cells that doesn't involve using silicon, which is how we currently make the solar cells. And basically, they work by having a photoelectron capture method at one end of a semiconductor, such as titanium dioxide, and they coat this with this dye at the anode. Now, more recently, researchers have introduced the reverse type of solar cell, where dyes interact with a different type of semiconductor, like a P-type semiconductor, such as niobium oxide, at a light harvesting cathode. The problem with these has been that they've been very inefficient.
is what you're going to tell me, that some bright spark has said, well, if we've got ones that work at the plus end and we've got another species that work at the minus end, can we glue the two together and we get light-sensitive anodes and cathodes and therefore you get a much more efficient way of doing things?
Well, yes, although where they are currently is that they've actually managed to make the cathode-type light harvesting cells much, much more efficient. In fact, they've doubled the efficiency of these. So now if you actually can imagine putting two relatively efficient things together and harvesting light at both ends of the photovoltaic cell, then yes, you could have a solar cell that is much more efficient than anything else out there.
Now, when we're saying inefficient, efficient, in the case of most solar cells, we're talking at, what, 10, 15% efficiency. So what does this mean in real terms for these devices? What are they anticipating if they can make this work then?
Well, they say that the current conversion efficiency, the best current conversion efficiency of some of these devices has now reached above about 44%. So you could be getting, it's pure speculation, but you could be getting, you know, double that if calculations were to be correct.
Which is staggering, isn't it, to think you can get a solar cell that efficient when we can't even make an engine that's, we know it's obviously it's a heat engine, therefore it's intrinsically inefficient, but we can't actually get anything close to that at the moment. So that's staggering.
It is indeed, yes, and hopefully we'll be able to, you know, these researchers will be able to save the planet by making us all use sunlight rather than anything else for our energy.
Let's hope so, but can you tell us when? Because that's kind of critical. We think we've got 20 years till it's too late. Are we going to do it in time?
Well, most times people will say 5 to 10 years and mean 20, so I'm guessing on about 30.
Well, hopefully they will get it down a little bit. Thank you very much for that, Matt. Now, Nina, let's look at spiders, because they make a wonderful material, spider silk. People are talking about using it for things like bulletproof vests, but now you're saying that scientists have come up with a way of making it even stronger.
They have indeed. So this group from the Max Planck Institute in Germany are publishing in Science, and they've strengthened spider silk by infusing metals like zinc, aluminium and titanium within them.
It sounds tricky. How do you get metal inside spider silk then?
They use a method called atomic layer deposition. So during this process, they heat the spider silk under hot water vapour, and then they infuse metal within them. And the water vapour disrupts the hydrogen bonding network within the proteins, and these hydrogen bonds are replaced by much stronger covalent metal protein bonds, and that's where the strength comes from.
So the metal ions end up embedded in the actual protein matrix. They get in the way of some of what would normally be water-to-protein interactions, and you then get a metal-protein interaction, and that cross-links lots of proteins and makes a very strong substance.
Exactly.
How can we use this? Is this practical?
No. So at the moment they're just looking at the fundamentals, because spider silk is something which you can only get in rather small amounts. But once they've understood the science behind it, they're hoping to move on, maybe looking at silkworms. And the kind of end goals that they're looking at is super strong surgical threads or artificial human tissues like bones and tendons.
Oh, right. So it's not just spider silk. You could apply the same technique to other silk type producers, including silkworms, to produce any kind of material that's got much greater strength.
In theory, yes. That's certainly what the researchers are looking to work towards.
Two silkworms had a race. Which one won? Well, of course, it ended in a tie. Thanks, Nina. This is the Chemistry World podcast with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, how power stations can produce hydrogen as a byproduct, and that's thanks to a new catalyst, and how a new generation of nanoparticles can release the right amount of insulin to suit blood sugar levels. But first, to how scientists have solved a long-standing mystery, why the levels of methane in the atmosphere suddenly shot up 14,000 years ago when the world warmed up. Did that methane come from carbon that was locked away in permafrosts, or was it previously sequestered under the sea? Perhaps it was both. Vas Petrenko.
During the end of the last ice age, what we see from ice core records is that there are two very sharp jumps in temperature, one at about 14.5 thousand years ago and one at about 11.5 thousand years ago, where temperature in Greenland increases by about 10 degrees Celsius in as little as 20 years. Very large, very rapid warming events. And associated with these warming events, there also increases in atmospheric methane concentrations. And these increases are quite large. In one case, the atmospheric methane concentration increased by about 50%. These increases also happened quite fast. And there's been a lot of debate in the scientific community about why methane was going up at this time and what was driving these methane increases. One of the main ideas that has been proposed for this is that during these warming events, on the whole, the world gets warmer and wetter. And what that would result in is an expansion of the world's wetlands, as well as possibly an increase in productivity of the world's wetlands. And wetlands happen to be the main natural source of methane to the atmosphere today.
So where does that methane come from? Why should an expansion of wetlands produce more methane?
The methane in the wetlands comes from methanogenic bacteria. So these are bacteria that produce methane in oxygen-depleted conditions in the wetlands from organic matter that is decaying in the wetlands. And these wetlands are very widely distributed in the world.
So what's the other theory? You mentioned there were two.
The other main theory has to do with methane clathrates. Methane clathrate is an ice-like substance composed of water and methane molecules, where methane molecules are locked in an ice-like cage of water molecules. And the substance is stable at higher pressures and lower temperatures. Methane clathrates are very widely distributed on the ocean floors as well as in permafrost. So you find these in a lot of ocean sediments, for example.
And so one would argue that for some reason at 11,000 and 14,000 years ago, something caused the ocean to belch up all this locked away methane, and that could have been the cause of this sudden surge in methane in the atmosphere and then the onward warming.
Exactly. That has been one of the hypotheses, that during these warming events, the warming triggered destabilization of a lot of these methane clathrates.
So how do you solve that conundrum? You don't know which of those two methods it is, and it was 14,000 years ago at worst. So how can you possibly wind the clock back that long to know which of those two is responsible?
Well, one of the ways to go about this is to use carbon-14. Now, carbon-14 is a very rare isotope of carbon that is radioactive, and it decays with a half-life of about 6,000 years. Now, it so happens that methane that's produced in wetlands has a fairly large amount of this carbon-14, whereas methane that is coming out of clathrates has essentially no carbon-14. And if carbon-14 of methane stays the same through this methane increase that we observe, that would mean that most likely the methane came from the wetlands, because wetlands are the main natural source, so we would expect that to be the background source. And if during an increase in methane, the carbon-14 doesn't change, that means that the sources really haven't changed. Whereas if we see that as methane concentration goes up, the carbon-14 level goes down, then we know that there's a large contribution from this reservoir of clathrates, which has no carbon-14.
Presumably you had to go and then get the ice to do this.
Glacial ice contains a fair amount of ancient terralloct in it. It's actually about 10% air by volume. But carbon-14 is extremely rare. It's about one part per trillion as compared to what you would call normal carbon. And methane is also a trace gas. It's present in the atmosphere in very low concentrations. So to get enough ancient air for one measurement, we actually needed 1 metric ton of ice for each sample. So we had to find a site at the western margin of the Greenland ice sheet.
So you go to that Greenland ice sheet, you excavate ice. How do you make sure it doesn't get contaminated with contemporary gases? And then how do you analyze it to see what forms of carbon are in there?
We try to use very clean sampling procedures. We cut this ice with clean electric chainsaws that don't use any lubricants, because lubricants are, of course, composed of organic material, which could contaminate our methane. And we load this ice into a very large vacuum chamber, where we first seal the chamber and evacuate all the modern air that's around the ice to avoid contamination by the modern atmosphere. Then we melt the ice under vacuum, and what that does is release the ancient air that's trapped in the glacial ice. Then we can transfer this ancient air into a storage cylinder and bring it back to the laboratory for analysis. And then before the carbon-14 in the methane can be analyzed, the methane actually has to be converted to first CO2 and then to graphite.
And when you do this, what do you find?
Well, what we see is a very small decrease in carbon-14. And what that is telling us is that predominantly the source for the methane increase was wetlands, but there was likely some contribution from sources that had either less carbon-14 or no carbon-14. So there possibly was some contribution from the methane clath rates.
So the big question now is, of course, what caused the warming event in the first place?
That is a big question. It definitely has something to do with the strengthening of the overturning circulation in the North Atlantic. When the climate is generally warmer, the circulation is a lot stronger. When the climate is colder, the circulation is weaker. And that certainly seems to be part of the puzzle, but that doesn't seem to explain all of the warming that we see. That's very much an open question at this point.
And one that we'll need to solve soon, because history could well be repeating itself as the world warms up because of climate change. That was Vaz Petrenko. He's at the Institute of Arctic and Alpine Research in Boulder, Colorado. And talking of climate change, hydrogen is said to be the fuel of the future because it's clean. The only combustion product is water. And now scientists are saying, James, that they've come up with a way to make power stations produce it as a byproduct.
Well, that's the idea. What this team at the University of Amsterdam, Urijn Beckers and Gedi Rothenberg, are suggesting is that you could sort of retrofit existing gas-fired power stations to not only produce energy, but also to produce hydrogen.
Why ever would we want that?
We all hear about hydrogen being the fuel of the future. We're all going to be driving hydrogen-powered fuel cell cars. But the question is, where do you get the hydrogen from? And obviously,
I was going to ask, do we need hydrogen? Can we not get it from other places? Is there a shortage?
Well, hydrogen can be made from other places. Obviously, there's no geological deposits of hydrogen like we can drill for oil. There's no drilling for hydrogen. Ultimately, the hope is that most of the hydrogen is tied up in water molecules. So if we could harness energy from the sun to split water molecules, then that would be a great source of hydrogen. But in the meantime, hydrogen typically comes from fossil fuels. And what these guys are suggesting is that a particularly flexible way to be able to make hydrogen would be to make it from within gas-fired power stations.
How?
Well, what they're suggesting is instead of just burning the methane, you actually react it over a catalyst. So this is a cerium oxide-based catalyst, which is doped with various metals. And what happens is some of the methane absorbs onto the cerium surface where it can then react with the metals embedded within it. So instead of just directly converting methane or reacting methane with oxygen to produce water and CO2 and releasing energy in the process, the methane breaks down so that you just, for every molecule of methane, you release two molecules of hydrogen and leave behind just the carbon.
And what happens to that then? Does that react with the oxygen to make CO2, or do you end up with sort of carbon deposits all over your catalyst?
No, that does indeed react with the oxygen in a subsequent step. So you do still get the energy out of that carbon, if you like, and you don't end up coking up your catalyst. The catalyst keeps going.
This sounds quite good. It's sort of two birds with one stone, because you're getting the hydrogen off, which presumably you separate from the exhaust stream, and that could go to whatever use you have for it. But also you're getting some electricity at the same time.
Exactly right. And what gas power stations are typically used for is what they call peak power stations, so that in times of peak energy demand, you switch the power station on. So potentially you could be running them all the time and streaming off hydrogen in low energy demand and then switching to burning all of the methane and getting as much energy out as you could in times of high energy demand.
Which sounds ingenious. Thank you very much for that, James. Now, let's go from gases to sugars. And this is interesting, Matt. Glucose-sensing nanoparticles. Tell us more.
Yes, indeed, Chris. And let me start with just by explaining why the researchers Xingzhu Jin and Xiaozhong Li of Nankai University in Tianjin are interested in developing these systems. And it's all to do with diabetes. And as most people probably know, that's to do with a dysregulation of insulin response to glucose or sugar in the blood. Now, what these researchers have done has developed a nanoparticle that actually responds to high levels of glucose and can release insulin to help break up the glucose and mitigate any effects that diabetes might have.
Why is this better than the present situation where a diabetic will monitor their blood and then inject a certain amount of insulin? Surely this is amounting to the same thing, because they've got to inject the particles, haven't they?
Well, the theory is that if you could put a once daily injection of a nanoparticle into the body, then the nanoparticle itself could sense when the blood needed the insulin in there better than we could ourselves, because obviously we look at the effects long term. So if we're feeling faint because we haven't got enough sugar in the blood, then you might go and take your blood sample and give yourself an injection. Whereas this way, your body would actually be keeping the glucose levels within a much tighter balance.
Which we think adds up to better long-term health, because we think it's the wild swings of glucose and insulin that probably make people with diabetes less healthy. So I can understand that. How have they done it? It sounds intriguing.
Well, what they've done is they've made polymers that cross-link to form this nanoparticle, but they actually reversibly cross-link. And what they've done is they've used boronic acids to form this cross-link. These are usually not used in medical applications because they're actually quite toxic. But because they cross-link between sugars, that a lot of that toxicity is negated. When these nanoparticles are then in the presence of glucose, the glucose interferes with that binding between the sugar and the boronic acid, disrupts that and releases the contents of the nanoparticle.
So how is the nanoparticle charged with insulin in the first place? Is it like a little capsule that then bursts, or is the insulin sort of bound onto something and it's released in a graded fashion in response to the sugar?
It's bound within pockets within the nanoparticle itself. And when I say pockets, it's all wrapped up amongst the polymers. And then when the glucose comes along, it will undo a certain number of these polymer strands so that you get a somewhat glucose concentration specific release. The big problem with this at the moment, say the researchers, is that they've only managed to get about a 10% loading of insulin in the nanoparticles. So you would have to take an awful lot of the nanoparticles to be actually able to cope with an insulin episode.
It's still an intriguing idea. I'm fascinated. I think it's a brilliant idea. But the thing I'm concerned about is what actually happens to those nanoparticles once you've injected them, because you said that they've got various boron-based things in them, which does have toxicity attached to it.
Well, that's something that they're yet to find out. They've got some very early preliminary experiments in mice that show that the nanoparticles can lower glucose levels to an extent. But the main challenge is to match the glucose sensitivity to the needs of diabetes patients and then find out what happens to the nanoparticles and really to test their safety in animals long term and to see how they are expunged from the body.
Indeed, but certainly very encouraging news. Thank you, Matt. Right, we're almost out of time, so we better catch up with the chemical conundrum. Please remind us of the question, James.
Well, we had a spring-related question last month, Chris, and that question was, what is the name of the most active member of the auxin family of plant hormones?
And the answer to the question was indole-3 acetic acid. And we'll be pulling the winner out of the hat later on today.
That's for a wonderful Chemistry World goodie bag. I've been entering 500 times every month and I still haven't won one, so they're highly sought after. What do you have to do to win one next month, James?
Well, to win one, the question that we have is, what were the Incas mining that caused mercury pollution in the Andes Mountains thousands of years ago? Which is quite an interesting story, and just as a subtle clue, you might be able to find the answer to that on the Chemistry World blog, which you can find the link to on our homepage.
And if you do dig up the answer, or perhaps you just know it, then do drop us a line. Please remember, though, to include your name and address, otherwise that goodie bag could go unclaimed, and you definitely don't want that to happen. The email address is chemistryworld@rsc.org. We'll be back reacting to more exciting chemistry next month, but in the meantime, don't forget there's also our weekly podcast, Chemistry in Its Element, where we take a look at the sinister side of the periodic table. You can tune in to Chemistry in Its Element on iTunes or via our website. That's at chemistryworld.org/elements. Chemistry World this month was brought to you by James Mitchell Crowe, Matt Wilkinson and Nina Notman. Production was by Mira Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. Until next time, thanks for listening, and goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.